Hey, 99 Pages, please forgive me for my delay in posting our April episode. The past few weeks were crazy for me. Took a vacation, I quit my job, started a new one, had a birth in the family, a death in the family, and then I was just intoxicated by that totality of the solar eclipse. That being said, I'm back in action. Today, I'm talking with Sudeep Krishna and Pourav Gandhi, authors of Lead from the Front, Tales of the Indian Military. India might be the country of my birth, but I'll be the first to say that I don't know the place that well. But what I can tell you is that it's a complex country with state and national struggles rooted in caste, religion, and poverty. It also is a nuclear power with decades of conflicts against neighboring countries. Now, I always thought that my service in the American military would make it harder to relate to my Indian roots, but I discovered through this book that the opposite is actually true. My time in Afghanistan has made it easier to understand the country and the tremendous opportunity that the next generation of Indians has ahead of them. The book Lead from the Front showcases incredible acts of modern-day heroism from another nation's military in conflicts within their borders. It was a powerful read. Now, if you enjoy today's conversation, please consider rating us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Those ratings help us out a ton. Please consider subscribing to our mailing list at 99pages.club for updates on our newest episodes and monthly nonfiction book reviews. Thanks, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. So Pourav, Sudeep, thank you so much for joining. This book was really, really special for me to read. As an American military officer, something a lot of people don't know about me is my uncle was actually an NDA, National Defense Academy grad, and went to be a wing commander in the Indian Air Force, and in many ways was the inspiration for me to pursue a military start to my career. And shame on me for never really looking to know anything about the Indian military, right? Like, it's part of my identity that I have kind of put in a box and put to the side. And you know, when I saw your book come out, when I heard the word lead from the front, what caught my eye is that's like a very common American military phrase. And I was wondering, what's this about? And I was like, wow, even this picture of on the cover of like modern soldiers. I was like, this is about guys in Afghanistan and Iraq, like me, right? No, yeah. It's about, you know, the Indian service. And so first off, and there's two of you here for the audience. There's two authors here, Pourav Gandhi and Sudeep Krishnan. First off, what I'd love to do is maybe have each of you introduce yourselves. Sudeep, maybe we'll start with you. Would you mind telling us a little bit about who you are and how you found your way to writing about the Indian service?
No, happy to. And Rajiv, thanks for having us on the podcast. It's an honor. And it was an honor also to bring some of these stories to life. So my name is Sudeep. I've a classic corporate jock. I worked in legal consulting for a little while, then got an MBA. I joined a bunch of companies, but spent majority of my time with Deloitte. I was a consultant. I grew up to be a partner and a leader in Deloitte. And what's happened is that over the last 17 years that I had spent with the firm, I got exposed to a lot of opportunities to lead and be led, right? And what I've realized was that through that leadership journey, in the corporate world, especially in well-known companies, leadership is an afterthought. And let me explain why, right? Because in many cases, what happens is that we tend to empower and train leaders when they already have become sort of, cross being small unit leaders or already senior leaders. And what happens is that, you know, the series of bad decisions that happen leading up to that point become institutionalized in their minds. And then you're trying very hard to try and correct a lot of those leadership traits pretty late in that process. Whereas my interest in the military was very interesting because I actually tried to get into the NDA, the National Defense Academy. The equivalent of, not exact equivalent, but comparable to what we have in West Point in the US. And I couldn't make it, right? But I fell in love with the armed forces and that love stayed with me for a really long time. And as I tried to compare the corporate worlds and the world of the armed forces, what I realized was that leadership is not, leaders are not born in the armed forces. I think leaders are made. And a lot of that leadership training happens in the academies where they get taught, and then, you know, live on the job, you know, experience that these leaders have. And, you know, a young lieutenant or a captain, it's very common for them to, you know, be company commanders, lead companies of 120 plus men into battle, you know, and they're only 25 or 26. And I thought back to what I was doing when I was 25 and, you know, ashamed to say not even 10% of what these guys do, right? So that was the, I would say that was the journey that I went through. And that's the point at which, you know, I combined with Purav, and that's where the idea came that, you know, we should write this book from the perspectives of civilians and try and bring some of these stories to light.
Super fascinating. One, I think as I hear your story, I hear a lot of similar experiences and perceptions of, you know, in the Western world as well. And I love the nuance of like, look, we're civilians, not just, and you're not civilian like academics or historians, you're civilians coming from a corporate background and actually paying homage to this other profession, which I actually think is really interesting. It's not like you see a bunch of lawyers writing about software engineers or doctors writing about, you know, any other profession. Like, you guys are from the one profession writing in homage to another. I think that's super interesting. Purav, how did you get wrapped up in all this? What's your story? I'd love to hear more.
Thanks, Rajiv. So, I'm Purav Gandhi. I'm a physician by education. So, come from a family where for three generations, everybody's a doctor. I also studied medicine. But then I took a slightly different path. I did an MBA. Sudeep hired me into my first job at Deloitte, joined his team, worked with him for around 5 years. But then another part of me, and for anyone of Indian origin, they would be able to relate. I'm a Gujarati by background. It's very entrepreneurial in terms of thinking and culture. So I left Deloitte, started on my own. And in Gujaratis, it's very uncommon to be associated with armed forces or military in any way. But around five and a half years ago, Sudeep, through many of his stories, and eventually had me visit the National Defense Academy in Pune. And this was my first exposure to anything related to the armed forces. And I was fascinated. It was just mind-blowing. I wish I had known about this before. I wish I had more background in this area. But I figured that with Sudeep's help, I would pursue this area, learn more around this. And then, like Sudeep said, like any other management consultant, started studying about this subject in a structured way that, hey, how do you dissect leadership in the armed forces? Can we create a framework around it? What are the key tenets of leadership? Also thought that this is something we have to share with the world on a broader scale. So I kind of started pursuing Sudeep that we have to write a book on this. We did multiple attempts. Initially, it started with an idea of creating a leadership framework on what a common man can learn from the armed forces in terms of being a better leader. As we spent more time on this journey, we met many leaders in the armed forces, each demonstrating leadership in a very different facet of life, and we'll talk about that a bit more. We learned that it's hard to distill everything into a simple framework, but the stories are super inspiring. And depending on your situation and context in life, there are different ways in which you can relate to it. There are different ways in which you can learn from it. So why don't we write the stories? The stories are the hero. The leaders are the hero. Why don't we talk about them? And people will get inspired in different ways from the stories. So that's how I got into this subject. And I wish I had started sooner, but it's never late. So finally, I got into the subject.
What came to mind first and foremost was the political context in which this book has been released, right? Like, one could argue the term Hindu nationalism might come to mind to describe the ways a lot of people might feel. And I mean, it just feels like there's a lot of political division, populism, nationalism occurring right now in India. Not unlike, by the way, many countries in the Western world, right? It's not like this is, you know, a bubble of chaos. It's obviously in a lot of different country parts of the country. But as you, you know, are going through and writing this book under very tense, you know, conflicts of identity in a very complex social fabric, like, how did you manage to keep, you know, all the stories on even keel? Like, I think you guys did a great job of making it a unifying story. And I'm curious how you, whether or not that came into your mind, how you structured your research around that problem.
It's a great question, Rajiv. And I'm so glad you noticed that part, right? I think right now we are going through those times where actually it's very easy to be nationalist or find any divisive theme and get popular along those lines. At the same time, it was a very conscious call that Sudeep and I continuously ensured that we keep going back to the roots and the reason why we started this effort. We were inspired not by one single national leader or one strong personality. The entire inspiration was a small unit leader, an everyday guy. And an everyday guy in the armed forces also, there are everyday people, right? They have their regular lives. They are fighting for their promotion. They have their family issues. And despite of all those things, when the moment comes, that individual, he or she, would rise to the occasion. And that's what leadership is all about. And if we go back to this individual, his or her motivation is not a strong, divisive theme. His or her motivation is to do something for the unit they belong to, is to do something right by their colleagues or the team that they are leading. Their motivation has always been a very positive, constructive theme. And then what we ensured was that within our narrative, we should reflect that positive nationalism and the positive inspirational theme, as opposed to trying to go for the popular more divisive themes which are right now going on. The idea was to, again, like I said, the story should be the hero. And if we stay true to that, and we ensure that we are not taking on any divisive themes.
Yeah, that's super interesting and dare I say challenging. I mean, really, what a difficult challenge and undertaking that must have been. And congratulations on skirting that very tense line. Let's put some names and some anecdotes to this virtue, right? What you're describing is like, hey, in order to unify and not divide, we have to transcend someone's identity, and we have to think of the story in the context of like someone who is rising to the occasion in service of their team. And when you look back on your research for this book, what is the most inspiring story for you? What really, you know, moves your heart when you talk about this book?
Many stories which we have covered, and some which we have not been able to cover, and all of them have been super inspiring. But the one that still kind of I have goosebumps talking about is the story where we talk about the story of this captain. His name is Captain D.P.K. Pillai. It's a fairly publicized story. But Sudeep and I were very fortunate. We had a chance to meet him firsthand and listen to his story, right? And this is a guy who is a second generation army guy. Posted in a very far off village in Manipur, which is in a tribal region in India. And they, in one particular instance, were raiding a village where there were insurgents. And these insurgents are Naxalites, which are essentially like your own people, right? They are not from another country. They are your own people who are fighting for a different cause, but creating trouble. And they ran an overnight operation. At the end, during that operation, during crossfire, he gets hit with a bullet. Now the guy is bleeding profusely. with all that, he still goes ahead and finishes the mission. Still follows entire protocol, where at the end of the entire mission, they are combing through the house where the insurgents were. A couple of them have surrendered. One of them has run away. One of them has been shot. And they find that in that crossfire, two young children have got hit. And he does his homework and he quickly realizes that, okay, this is fire from the Indian soldiers. This is not the Naxalite fire. So this has been collateral damage caused by his men. And he's on the verge of fainting. This village has no accessibility by road. So evacuation is a long journey. Any medical care is at least 6 hours away from the village. Now, being the senior most officer, protocol dictates that he will be evacuated first from that area. And there's a chopper that comes to evacuate him. It's a small chopper, so only one person can be loaded in the chopper. And he doesn't have a choice, actually. He would be evacuated, but he forces his men to say that, okay, if we go, these children will die. And then he calls his boss and says, I refuse to be evacuated. His boss makes a call to the Air Force guy and then requests these two children be evacuated first. And these two children are evacuated. In the meanwhile, he's losing blood, about to lose consciousness. So then he takes a promise from his men that, look, if the chopper doesn't come back in time and if I don't survive, promise me that you guys will not take revenge on this village. It is not their fault and you cannot take revenge on these men. You will let it go. Fortunately, the chopper arrives. He goes back, takes 6 months, gets recovered, eventually leaves the armed forces. These two children also survive. Fast forward 20 years, one of his friends visits that village when he's posted there. And during that trip, he sees a bust, a statue at the entrance of the village in the name of late DPK Pillai, because all the villagers believe that this guy has died, right? And then he asks, they say that this was the guy who gave his life while saving two kids from that village. And then he is invited back as a hero's welcome to that village more than 20 years later. Comes to know that insurgency in that village stopped since that day because he was willing to give his life to save the children. And then that's when everybody got motivated through that example. You know, when I saw this, when we heard this story, right, and every time I hear it, you just get goosebumps listening to the story that, okay, if somebody, and I've met this guy, he'll make jokes, he could talk very random things. But in the moment when it really mattered, he stepped up and he did what was right by any means. He went beyond protocol, he went beyond all the call of duty and did the right thing. And I think these are the instances or moments, right, which could be life-changing, which define true leadership.
It's a really great one. Like 20 years later, and there's a statue erected in this guy's honor. Like, that's incredible. What a great story.
You know, we also call it unlimited liability, right? And that's the essence of leadership, wherein your liability to your mission, your men, is unlimited, right? And that's the title of the story. And I remember when we finally wrote it, and I wrote the final version of this, I had gone out somewhere to write it. And it was so emotional that I sent it across to Purav. And then I started driving and I just couldn't hold back because then I started crying while driving, right? And I had to pull up to the side of the road because for someone to do that, and in that moment when you're all shot up, you know, you're almost unconscious to say that, listen, my life is not important, but the life of those lives of those two little children, those lives are more important. It just requires someone, you know, someone who's special, because our instinct for self-preservation is so high. And at that moment, it's also easy to say that, hey, these guys are the enemies, right? Because I'm fighting them in a way. But for him to rise above all of that in that moment, you know, rise above the need to preserve himself, need to think that these two children are not the enemy. It's not their fault. They're just sort of just the wrong place at the wrong time. I think for me and for Purav, I think that was the story that really stood out.
So, you know, I think there's something very interesting about the Indian identity here to be extrapolated from why this story resonates so deeply with you and why you chose it as one of the most important stories in the book. What, I mean, what is, you know, we hear stories of military gravitas and bravery all the time, but, you know, there's something very telling about the story. Why do you think this one is so powerful for the Indian identity?
You know, I think the way we approach that, Rajiv, is that, as Purav said, for us, the story was supreme. But having said that, we also wanted to get the elements into the story, which was more about the humanity behind some of these actions, as opposed to, you know, things that divide people, right? Because, you know, in the Indian context, caste divides you, regions divide you, religions divide you. The color of your skin, believe it or not, would divide, you know, citizens of this country. And I think that's very common across the world, because those are the things that you identify with. But end of the day, you know, we forget that we're all human beings, right? We might come from, you know, different parts of the country or the world. We might believe in different gods. We might, you know, sort of look very different from each other, but end of the day, we are human beings. And I think in many ways, when we are looking for these stories, those were the elements that we are also trying to search for, because we felt that the humanity of doing what you're doing is what will unify that. And, you know, we spoke about Colonel Pillai's story. I think it was humanity end of the day that pushed him to do what he did. There's also this other story in the book. It's called, you know, Turning the Tide. It's about this young army captain who was a company commander in Kashmir, and he was you know, running counterinsurgency operations in Kashmir. And there was this, you know, I think a 50-60 square kilometer area that was under him. And one of the things that he realized is, look, this camp that he was leading had about 120, 140 odd men, and there were villages around these camps. And we've got to remember that, you know, Kashmir is at the forefront of this sort of divisive nature of the game, because on one hand, you have the army, and on the other hand, you have, you know, the local population who don't particularly enjoy having the army in their area, right? But the army is there to maintain peace, because it's definitely a part of the country where there's a bit of that feeling amongst the local citizens that, you know, they want to be independent, they don't want to be a part of India. And there's a lot of history on both sides of that argument. But when this guy, he was on the ground, and he realized that, let's say, a certain amount of ration is allocated to his company. He realized that his men would pile on their plates during meals with a bunch of food and not eat half of it, right? So a bunch of this food was being wasted every day. And when he looked around the villages that were under his area of operation, he found that, you know, they're very poor villages, very poor villagers. Many of them would go to sleep hungry because they couldn't afford two square meals a day. And, you know, that's the level of poverty you see in some parts of India. And then it struck him that, look, in the camp, we are wasting food. And right outside the camp, there are people who are living in those areas who are going to bed hungry. And then he sort of convinced his men. He said, listen, why don't you just take less food on your plate when you first pick up this food, and you can go for seconds.
Yeah.
And when he did something as simple as that, right, when he did that, what he realized was that there was a, you know, there was less food wastage, and they were saving ration. About 20-30% of, you know, the food stocks that were there, they were saving because people are not consuming and wasting as much. So, in fact, he asked the cook within the camp to cook, you know, a meal, and then he decides to go to those villages and offer that to these hungry villagers. Right. And remember, these hungry villages could harbor a terrorist or a militant, because they would provide logistical support to a lot of terrorists who this guy was fighting. Initially, the villagers were very suspicious, but it was the young, you know, small, hungry children who came forward to eat that meal. And, you know, the fascinating thing was after that day, no child ever went to bed hungry in those villages, right? Now, you would say that this guy is Hindu. The villagers that he was feeding were Muslims. But that's not the way he thought. I think from his mind, his whole approach was that I'm a human being. They are human beings. They have a right to live a life which is as good as the one that I'm living. And I think in many ways, those are the factors, the humanity behind that story that sort of brought these two groups together.
One thing the military in the United States, you know, does arguably very well is to keep conflict off our shores. And as a result, we preserve our economy, we preserve day-to-day life for the vast majority of American people. The downside is that it creates this civil-military divide, which is really big. What's interesting about the stories that you've told and a lot of the context of the Indian military is that, you know, the conflicts are either right at the border or inside the border, right? Whether it's Sri Lanka, Kashmir, or even domestic terrorism, that's very real and far unlike anything that we've seen in recent years in the Western United States, and sorry, in the Western world. These conflicts are like in your backyard, right? And I'm curious if you think that makes a difference here, you know, because these folks are operating in areas that are like geographically like very close to them. How does that change their behavior or their perception of conflict? Either one, Purav or Sudeep, would love your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I can go first. And, you know, whenever these conflicts are happening within the borders, first of all, I think within the population, and I go back to the last major war that we fought, it was the Kargil conflict that happened in 1999, I was a teenager at that time. And, you know, sort of late teens, early 20s at that time. And I remember had I made it to the NDA, I probably would have gotten commission around that time. So for me, it became very, very real. But in many ways, the Kargil war, you know, created this groundswell of support for the army. And it was very visible. It was very visible amongst the population of this country because the interesting thing about India is that India has always been about defending our borders as opposed to, you know, being on the offense. In fact, the only offensive maneuver we ever did was the 71 war, where the Indian Army got involved in the liberation of Bangladesh because, you know, we had an influx of refugees who came in from Bangladesh, and the Indian Army had to step in and liberate, and hence a new country was created. But we didn't stay, right? Once the country was created and everyone, sort of the administration took over, the local Bangladeshis, we came back. So the Indian Army doctrine always has been that of aggressive defense. And what that also does is it also gives a certain moral ascendance within the country, where I've seen many cases where you know, citizens of this country are standing behind the army and the armed forces because, hey, they are out there defending our borders. And there is that very deep emotional connect saying that, look, if these guys are not standing on those borders, then, you know, whoever is threatening those borders can come and hit us. And if you look at India's history, we've always been invaded by many large powers, right? So we've been invaded by the Greeks, by, you know, the Turks, by the
Greeks,
Arabs.
Persians, the British.
Persians.
Exactly,
right? Yeah. So I think what I, and this is my belief, which I strongly believe that, you know, in the Indian mentality, that thing is hardwired, saying that, look, if we don't defend these borders, then some other invaders will come and invade and take away what we worked so hard to build. So I think that's where the society's connection with the military is very deep. And if you look at the composition of the military, you'll see that there's larger contributions that happen to the Indian Armed Forces, especially the serving enlisted soldiers. The officers come from all across the country, but majority of the enlisted soldiers are from the west and the north of India, because you know they've been at the receiving end of a lot of those invasions that have historically happened in the country. The south of India has been relatively shielded from those invasions, right? So I think that's what drives the emotional connect that the society has with the armed forces. I mean, if there's one institution in this country that is above caste, creed, corruption, all of those things, it's the Indian Armed Forces. And I think the army works very hard to keep it that way.
That's excellent. Yeah. You know, and by the way, we're not talking about a small service. I think India's military, I think the Air Force alone is like the fifth largest or fourth largest Air Force in the world. Like, we are talking about a large organization here. And of course, India is the largest democracy in the world. It's a large and complex bureaucracy, just like any other institution, yet it is still held in such high regard. Let me ask you another question about, and this is something I think about with just in the nature of conflict in general. So what's interesting about all these anecdotes and the stories, lots of, you know, human moments between civilian and soldier, beautiful moments where even under the duress of fire, I'm able to summon my humanity, look into someone's eyes, see their humanity and act with their well-being in mind. I love it. What I see, though, is that warfare is becoming increasingly digital and fought with a computer screen and increasingly automated. And let's just say the human elements, particularly in a nuclear world, are becoming less and less potent, right? You're not necessarily looking into the eyes of the bystanders anymore. And I'm curious, as you did your research, is there any reason to believe that this level of virtue can continue as warfare becomes increasingly automated and digital? Or do you think that you know, as we get further removed from the exposure to the human bystanders, human targets of conflict, that we will make just poor decisions as military leaders? I'm curious, you know, Purav, if that has struck you at all in this journey.
Oh, it's a great question, Rajiv. I think there are two competing forces, in my opinion. One part is how warfare becomes digitalized and nuclear and more automated, and many flights don't even have a fighter pilot, and you are using drones to fight. On the other side, what this era also does is there is an increased amount of digital scrutiny all the time. And especially if you are fighting the battle within your organization, within your country, within your shores, you're very close to the population. So the moral scrutiny, the kind of visibility that you have as an organization is very, very high. And so as we think about this, especially I can speak to the Indian part because that's what I'm close to and I've seen closely. You have to be very, very clear in terms of defining what your military doctrine is, what your DNA is. If you're fighting a battle far away from your shores, one misstep could be penalized but could go unnoticed. Here, very difficult, like in Kashmir Valley region where we have stone pelting, one rubber bullet from the military guys or one tear gas bomb injuring a civilian can get blown into a disproportionate act of offense from the military. Mm-hmm. So I think these two counterbalancing forces where the army does not need to look everyone in the eye, but at the same time, every action is way more closely scrutinized, can get hyperinflated and spread out very fast, believe is a good balancing force, where if your military doctrine and your moral compass is strong, the need to ensure that everybody in the organization from top to bottom understands and follows that code will become stronger over a period of time as compared to weaker.
You know, that's an interesting assertion. So the idea that technology can even though we are, you know, using more digital and remote sources of warfare or tools in warfare, the ability to scale policy makes it in many ways safer or better, because it you're allowed to think in the silence of, you know, your own meditation. You're able to think of your virtues, create the policies, digitize them, and scale them, therefore making sort of regimenting quality decision making. You know, as a former infantry officer myself, my thought is actually it is the regimentation itself which is in many ways the problem. Because what I hear in a lot of these moments, particularly like the story of the person shot up and who says, you know, and according to policy, that officer is supposed to be evacuated first. Well, in an sort of automated regimented policy distribution, you know, that officer may not have had the leeway to break with protocol and, you know, actually make the humanitarian decision. So does it actually, you know, scale good decision making, or are we just simply taking away authority from the battlefield commanders to use their virtues or so on and so forth? I'm curious if you have any reaction to that.
So I'll just share one thought, and then Sudeep, you can also share yours. So I go back to the Kashmir story which Sudeep talked about around food, right? And like you said, regimentation is the strongest force, right? And for most civilians, believe that in army, everything is command and control. And if as an officer, you have defined something, men will follow. And that's absolutely not true. So in the story of this colonel, where food was being wasted, he obviously tried to bring that to notice of his men that, hey, food is wasted and should not do that. And the guys could care less, right? They didn't listen. This is a new officer, young guy, 25 years. These guys have been serving for donkey's years.
You can't spell lost without LT. That's my favorite phrase on that one.
And then what he did was he said, like, okay, where they put the waste food, he asked the cook to go and bring the bread which has been thrown away and store that. And he said, every day you will warm up that bread and serve me while the other men are having fresh food. And he started eating this bread for 3, 4, 5 days, right? Now the guys are noticing and the word spread. And then they're like, dude, if the officer is eating our bread, which we are throwing away, this just cannot go on. The regimentation, these stories, right, are still very relevant. Only the policy, only the rules are not enough. And you have to hope that in this information era, these things would also spread faster, but will also subject the officers and leaders to a much higher scrutiny. Yeah. One loose act, one loose comment would travel very fast. In a similar way, one good act, one demonstration of leadership will spread at the same pace. Yeah. And hopefully that will ensure that more and more people get inspired in a faster way.
That's a brilliant point. You know, there's a fine balance in military service between autonomy and isolation, I think is what you're saying. I think that's really wise. Sudeep, I'm curious if you have anything to contribute here.
No, I totally agree with Purav. And yeah, you know, if you go through these stories, and the reason why we chose these stories is there's regimentation, which drives discipline, which drives consistency of action. But end of the day, each of these leaders use their own moral compass and their own drive to make decisions. So in many cases, each of these stories talk about the individual's personal agenda to make something happen. And that yielded results which were, you know, superlative in many ways. So I personally feel that every leader, be it the corporate world, be it the military, has the opportunity to take decisions which are inspired by their own learning, their own personality, their own beliefs. And I think those who take those decisions are the ones who make magic happen.
So let's dive into this, because I think it's super interesting. When you think about these leaders from the Indian military, I mean, amazing heroes, but where did, you know, like you said, leaders are not born, they're made. Were they actually forged in training in IMA, NDA, the Indian Military Academy, National Defense Academy, like kind of the West Point and Sandhurst of India? Or is there something about being raised as a child in Indian culture that hardens you, that softens you, that makes you more sensitive to the human condition? Like, where do you think the forging of these really wonderful virtues actually occurred?
Look, I think, I personally think it's both, right? So there's the upbringing. So when you talk about values and you talk about principles of leadership and values, I think the values are the ones that a lot of these people have actually learned at home. They've observed their parents, they've observed the ecosystem in which they've grown. They have observed people who they looked up to as heroes when they were young. I mean, there's this fascinating story about Captain Vikram Batra, who got the equivalent of the Medal of Honor in the Indian system called the Paramveer Chakra during the Kargil War. And, you know, Captain Batra's story is fascinating because he grew up idolizing other winners of PVCs before him. And he grew up, you know, observing his parents putting others before them, right? And in many ways, those are the values and the principles by which he decided he's going to live his life. And I think you're right. Part of that is, you know, you imbibe the spirit of leadership by what you learn in these academies. You sort of nurture it a bit more when you actually join your regiment. You become one with the men that you're leading. And by the way, there's also the history that the regiment has, right? I mean, some of these Indian regiments have been around for 300 plus years because they were formed under the British Indian Army. And then after India gained independence, have continued a bit of that history forward. So these guys are taught that history, saying that, hey, listen, we fought 200 years ago in Afghanistan, or we fought in the First World War, or the Second World War, and so on and so forth. But I genuinely believe that a lot of that is what they are taught over a period of time. But there's that inner moral fiber that a lot of these leaders have had, which is what they've imbibed through the values that they learned while they were growing up, even before they joined any of these academies or got commissioned as officers. And we've seen that consistent thread in all of them. In fact, I was also, I think the question I have in my mind is that, you know, what propelled them? Because it's a volunteer army, and some of them are second or third generation military officers, but many of them are first generation officers, right? So they've chosen to get into the military world. And in many cases, I think the values by which they've grown up are the ones that have propelled them to come. I know a couple of cases of individuals who've given up admission into the Indian Institutes of Technology, which is, I think, one of the toughest institute to get into in the world, and instead have come and joined the NDA. So there's a larger purpose that you know, and calling that got them to end up where they've ended up eventually.
Phenomenal. When you think of, you know, both of you have really successful careers in business and management and have spent most of your lives working with senior business leaders, particularly from the Indian context, right? Because most of my listeners, I don't think are really familiar with, you know, Indian corporate culture. And there are absolutely differences between the way, you know, corporate cultures operate in different countries and parts of the world. I'm curious, what are the specific lessons you're hoping that, say, Indian corporate leaders are going to take away from this book and the way they manage their businesses and the Indian economy at large? Curious what you're hoping they take away.
Purav, you want to take that? I'll step in.
Sure. I'll say a few from top of my mind, and Sudeep, you can add. But I think some tenets which we learn from this journey, and like Sudeep said, a lot of values, a lot of things that people have been exposed to in their formative years create potential. And then the specific training at some of these military academies kind of manifest the potential, because then you learn what good really looks like. You know how far you can push your limits. You learn to get into a culture which is high performing, and then you want to ensure that you live up to that culture. And if I take that into corporate world, some of the most important things, right, I think, and very relevant in this area, I think competence is at the core of it, right? Being really good at and practicing very hard to be good at what you do. Fighter pilots, great example. Most of them fly sorties their entire life without sometimes even having to fly a single real mission in their life, right? And you still keep practicing and stay at the cutting edge of what you are, you do every day. Second, the entire concept of ownership and accountability, and getting to unlimited liability, where solving the problem is of paramount importance. Process is important. All other things are important, but outcomes are most important. And having that accountability is, again, something which many can draw as a lesson. Third, building a culture of performance and ensuring that that is rewarded, acknowledged consistently will ensure that people have heard those stories and they are regimented in their minds, where when the time comes, that is the natural instinct, is another fairly important area. For this, leading by example, setting an example through some of these things and ensuring that people look up to you in every aspect, that is how magic happens within small teams, becomes another area which we want people to take away. I don't know, Sudeep, if you would like to add to that.
No, I'll just maybe reinforce your last point there. And in many ways, Rajiv, the title of the book, Lead from the Front, came from, you know, this one of these officers we spoke to, where, you know, in the infantry, and I'm sure that's true in the US as well, but in the Indian context, the officers always lead. You know, they are always at the forefront. And when you're running into a firefight and there are bullets coming from the opposite side, the officer has to lead and the men follow. And I was asking this this leader, saying, hey, aren't you scared? And he said, of course I'm scared. Mm-hmm. Right? And I said, then how do you get yourself to run into a hail of bullets, right? And he said, there's no other option, because, you know, in infantry action, you have to run in. And he said, by the way, if I don't do it, then my men are not going to do it, right? And that's the essence of leading from the front, wherein I go first and they follow me. But he said, there's a fascinating thing I want to tell you, wherein when I lead, my men make it a point to ensure that they take care of me, mm-hmm. right? So he said, they combine their efforts in such a manner that they are at a point, they say, listen, the officer cannot get hurt. And he said, I can't describe it to you, but years and years of this, these, you know, running into bullets, a lot of people have survived because as a team, the team has followed the leader and team ensured that everyone is taken care of. So in many ways, I think, you know, leading from the front, setting that example, in many ways gets the morale of the team up so high that everyone steps in and takes care of each other. That happens very naturally in the armed forces. Sorry to say, it doesn't happen as often as it should in the corporate world. There's a lot of leading from behind that happens in the world that.
I mean, and what's interesting, and I'm sure this crossing your mind when you might remember, I think about a year ago, roughly January 2023, Hindenburg Research published this very damning report about the Adani Group. And for those who aren't familiar, the Adani Group in India, it's like General Electric mixed with Honeywell, mixed with, it's like the industrial, it's this industrial powerhouse. They own ports, they own manufacturing, they own banks, finance, it's a massive group. And this equivalent of like an Enron level scandal, right? A huge scandal of accounting errors and deception, tax evasion. And one of the, I think at the time, he was like the second or third richest guy in the world. It falls to pieces, you know, it just, this whole empire just starts crumbling. And this is a real example where character, virtue, ethics have been blatantly disregarded in a Indian corporate infrastructure, right? And I'm curious for either of you, as you were doing this research, reading about all these military heroes, trying to send this message to corporate America. And then all of a sudden, this, you know, high-flying disaster happening in Ahmedabad, I believe, is where the Adani Group is headquartered, right in your backyard, Purav. You know, I'm curious, what went through your head? Did you have any emotional reaction to watching this downfall?
I'll let Purav take that because, you know, he's obviously in the middle of all that action. Go ahead.
Well, very interesting analogy. So, obviously, like when the report came out, right, and we thought that, okay, this is going to be a serious meltdown, breakdown of a large corporation. Very interestingly, I'd say like against all odds, they have survived. They have actually come out on the right side of the entire controversy around Hindenburg report. And I think finally their stocks are also again climbing back to the previous levels that they were at. But again, it's a very complex phenomena, hard to describe. Where on some of the things I believe like they have shown leadership, Adani Group, if I can speak about, like they've built infrastructure in India at a crazy scale, at an unprecedented scale in terms of airports, ports, roads, which never existed in the country. They've taken huge risks in that process to, and in those cases, I believe that they have led, they have shown execution capability, which is incredible. Now, when it comes to corporate governance, arguably they have not shown or demonstrated the same quality of leadership, and that's what they got challenged on. Hopefully, they course correct that and start fixing those pieces as well. But I think this is a good example, right? I think governance or some parts is where they failed. But the fact that overall, they contributed to building of the nation, they did survive as a large organization despite such a huge controversy. But otherwise, like again, I'm also not very well read on the topic to comment on the specifics.
That's all good. No,
but you know, that's a fascinating thing that what's fascinating is that not a lot of companies that Hindenburg have targeted have necessarily survived and have not come back, right? And Adani's have. And probably the reason what Purav alluded to is that, you know, there are actual assets backing at least a part of that inherent valuation. And I think what the market said is, look, we'll bring the valuation down to what is supported by those assets. There are roads, there are power plants, there are ports, and that actually exists, and they contribute a significant amount of cash flow to the group, right, on an ongoing basis. But having said that, yes, corporate governance. Honestly, corporate governance is a topic which, you know, is an area of interest for me. I've done a lot of research in that space, and I think we in India have miles to go, you know, before we can call ourselves, you know, sort of comparable, say that we're comparable to where some of the Western countries are, right?
Yeah.
But they've come back, and that's something you've got to acknowledge.
But exactly, and you know, thank you for providing that nuance, Sudeep and Purav, because like I mentioned, right, like for those of us in the United States and the Western world, we're not really following the day-to-day of the Indian economy, and so when this big headline of the Adani Group downfall comes out, the knee-jerk reaction is like, wow, that is just a case in point Enron corruption scandal, like good riddance, you know, wash them out. But you're saying something really interesting here, which is like, and I think it's actually a really important coda to your book, which is the fact that leadership is not just a moment in time, it's a journey, and you're gonna mess up, you're gonna fall down. Every company in the world at some point screws up royally, right? And the further away you're removed, like me reading the news from the United States, I don't get the context. I don't get all the other things upholding it. I just see the shallow headline that's negative. But for those in the fight, for those that built this organization, there is still a lot of value and virtue operating behind the scenes, and they're going to build back up. And that's a really wonderful anecdote. You know, another thing that happened in the past year that I'd love to get your thoughts on before we close out here is Chandrayaan. India put a vessel on the face of the moon. I mean, what? First off, this hit a special place in my heart. My uncle, who I may have mentioned to you that served in the Indian Air Force, his name was Chandramouli. And so like when I saw the name of the vessel, Chandrayaan, going to the face of the moon, I was like, that's him. That's my late uncle. I'm sure as you researched the armed forces, there had to have been folks that were loosely even tied to the aerospace efforts in India. I'm curious what you heard, what you found, and what went through your heart when you saw that successful mission.
I mean, it was a super proud moment, right? Because what's interesting is, you know, the world of the armed forces is very opaque in the sense, you know, a lot of things are classified. A lot of Air Force programs that happen, we are not really aware of. But for institutions like ISRO or NASA, their failures and successes are very public, right? And we got to acknowledge that this was our second attempt at it, because the first attempt went all the way to the moon and failed. So when this attempt went up there, and I remember there was a moment when the lander was hovering on the surface of the moon for a little while, and my heart was in my mouth saying that now this is the moment, right? From here, if they are not able to land, then that's another failure. And it's very heartbreaking when that happens. But I'll tell you what, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people in the Air Force, and there's always this, and you know, the Indian Armed Forces and the defense establishment is moving towards what we call is domestic production as opposed to imports. Right, because the whole idea is that we need to be a lot more self-sufficient in the way we research, manufacture, defense equipment, and we've had our first homegrown fighter aircraft called Tejas that I think we have four or five Tejas squadrons that are already in operation, not completely indigenized. The engine that Tejas uses is actually a GE-404. We import, but a lot of avionics are domestic. And I was talking to a few of these Air Force guys, and you know, for the first time over the last 5 or 6 years is where I've started seeing a sense of pride and belief that Indian equipment could be as good as Western equipment or Russian equipment that we've typically imported, right? And every time we do something like Chandrayaan, we land, and deliver something which is technologically very complicated, it just gives these guys who, end of the day, he's up there, he or she, they're up there, they're flying their aircraft, it has to perform, and it has to bring them back home safely, right? So every time we are able to cross a technology threshold, it gives these guys a lot of confidence saying that, hey, we are able to land, a spacecraft on the moon. So I'm very sure the next Indian-made fighter aircraft that we're going to have will be as good as, say, a Rafale or a F-16 or an F-18, right? So I think that's where doing these things is very important for the belief system to develop in the local ecosystem.
That's awesome. What a great, great, I think that'll be a great one for us to end our conversation on. You know, Purav, Sudeep, I got to tell you, this was such a cool book for me to read. You know, I get to read a lot of books doing this podcast, get to talk to a lot of authors. But almost all our, I'd say 95% of what we do is very rooted in the Western world. And especially as, you know, I'm an American citizen, I'm an former American Army officer, I live in the United States. In many ways, you know, the only thing Indian about me these days is my name. But what's really been special for me is to find areas of connection for me in my, you know, the country of my birth, the country of my ancestors. And just to see the success, the pride, the virtue, the humanity, and just such, you know, just good people serving in that armed forces, that institution. That that was just so wonderful for me to read. And I hope this book not only is successful in India, but for the Indian diasporas that are around the world, in Europe, in North America, in Africa. There's Indians all over the world and very tight-knit diasporas. And I think that each of these communities will get a lot of value from reading this book. So thank you guys for your hard work. Very proud of you guys.
Thank you, Rajiv. Thanks for having us. It's an honor. And next time you're in India, just, you know, let us know. We'll try and see if you can get a flavor of you know, army life in India. We'll take you to an infantry battalion here. It should be good fun.
Man, I'm done with that stuff. Put me up in the put me up in a nice fancy hotel. Give me some fancy meat. Man, I'm trying to forget about all that.
Nah, you. Once an army guy, always an army guy. You know, you can't take that away.
Station in India to go hang out with some infantry dudes. Hey, thank you so much for listening to that conversation. I had a blast. And if you did too, I hope you'll consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Those help us out a ton, as well as your ratings. Now, I also would ask you to sign up for our email list at 99pages.club. Every 2 weeks, I send out either a summary of our most recent podcast episode out for release, or a few nonfiction book recommendations to add to your list. Most people seem to like them. So I hope you'll join our community, and we'll be back with a new episode very soon.